The following is a conversation with Robert Lee.
Maybe we could start with you talking about you and focusing.
Sure. So I want to tell a little story about how I first came upon focusing.
Yeah.
I was doing a journey for several months on the East Coast, where I was visiting intentional communities that had a emphasis in spirituality and what I call progressive psychology. And so I was going to these places in North Carolina and Virginia and working my way up New York. And so I'm headed towards Montreal, I think, and I come into Burlington, Vermont. This is in 1980. Mm-hmm. And there was still daylight out. It was getting towards evening, but still daylight. And so I looked for a health food store or natural foods or a co-op or some such thing, because that was kind of a cultural gathering place. And I found one and went in and got my little thing for my little food and all that stuff. And then I went to the bulletin board, because they had these great little bulletin boards, and kind of got a sense of things. And so I was looking at the bulletin board, and there was this little note that said, "Focusing session, $10. And I just was kind of drawn to it. And I said, I think I'm going to call them up and see if they can do one tonight.
Did you know what focusing was, or just it was just?
No idea. I didn't. I saw the word, and something in me was drawn to it. I said it's funny, in a sense of itself, I guess. So I call up this person. Is a woman, Jane Presley. Was is her name, and so I'm a man on the road, and I'm saying, let's have a session tonight. So she was kind of saying, well, I don't know about that. And so I said, well, let's see if we know someone in common, because, you know, or someone sort of in common, or some growth approach, and then you could know I was all right, or maybe all right. Anyway, so we took about 20 minutes, and we found, I forget who it was or what approach it was, but we found something, and she felt okay, and I felt okay. So I went over, and she did this great focusing session for me.
So that was your first experience of focusing, just landing in Vermont at dusk and noticing this on the bulletin board.
And then I guess it was, I didn't do much after that, and then I was studying an approach to consciousness, and I was writing a dissertation about it. And I asked my mentor, I said, what in psychology is like this? Because I had a kind of a spirituality, psychology, and social change triumvirate for me. Mm-hmm. And so one day they handed me the book Focusing, and they said that's the most similar thing in psychology.
Hmm.
And I thought I read that and even did a little focusing following the instructions. And then I went to a humanistic psych conference in Chicago where Jinlin presented. And so and I wrote him a letter about my dissertation where I was putting something about focusing in it, not much, but a little bit. And he wrote me back and read it or said, send it to me. I don't think he reads those things, but I was so thrilled that he wrote me back and sent him a copy or whatever. Then my mentors, it was actually a couple, ended up going to the University of Chicago doctoral program in philosophy and kind of studying with Gene, so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
On the way. But it was all just these things happening, but not real entry until I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and someone told me about this changes group, and I was very poor because I was just living off of an internship that paid like $5 an hour or something. And I just had no money, and here was this changes group, and it was great. I went the first night, and they had a thing for newcomers, and I went every Sunday night. And I mean, unless I was out of town, I just went every week. And it was a really incredible system they had. They literally gave focusing away. I mean, they were a changes group, but then you could come for 10 hours of instruction, and someone who wanted to learn to teach would teach you everything free. Or maybe it was $3 so we could pay the rent.
Yeah. So it was really a question of something of really wanting to make it available to people.
Yeah, it's just like that. And there were some wonderful people. I just got the quality of leadership. I told someone else about it, and she went with me, and she was kind of a leader, and Zach Bukitis was organizing it, and Mary Lawler, another person who became a coordinator, was in the group, and just many others. So, and that was really where I formed. After a year, I started teaching the new people all for free, and then another year or two passed, and we started a regional changes gathering, and so a few groups in the area started, and then we started a second meeting, an earlier meeting, because some people wanted to meet earlier, and we thought it would be some people would come to the 6 o'clock meeting and some to the 7:30 meeting. But a lot of times, most of the people from the 6 o'clock meeting would decide to stay for the 7:30 meeting. So it was so interesting to have two rounds like that.
So I get a sense as you talk that certainly a big part of what made focusing so appealing to you was the quality of the people and the group that focusing was happening in.
Yeah, it was really just a very interesting group. And then I started a changes group in training at a Quaker meeting, a fairly famous one in Cambridge, and we had like 17 people who decided to do it. So. And so that was also on Sunday. And then started another group of about 10 there. And so at one time there were two groups at the Cambridge meeting and two of the regular Sunday night groups in Cambridge. I had four changes groups on Sunday.
Wow.
It was just, it was deep, it was rich. I remember this Harvard trained doc. And he said he had done all this psychoanalysis and all this other psychotherapy of different shapes and kinds, and nothing had helped with his depression until he came to this group, and then it just went away. I mean, I feel very blessed. Kathy McGuire was never there when I was there, but she and Zach had formed the group, and also I think Joan Flagsman and Neil Friedman had been in on the beginning of it. But I think Kathy and Zach and their design was really quite extraordinary also.
Yeah. So they were really exceptional people. Focusing itself was something that allowed a certain kind of communication, a certain type of connection. Does it make sense to make the part of the people and the focusing, or is this something that doesn't quite feel right?
Let me just think about that for a moment. Let me stay with it. The people, I think, and the design are both.
The design of the group, yeah.
Yeah. But it feels like that will take me in new directions, and I actually want to tell my story. I think what I want to do is I want to talk about how the changing the unchangeable work that
wonderful
that known for how it developed right in this group, because there were people. So I'm going to the group every week and stuff, and so one woman was very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you would just feel the weight when you would trade terms with her. And after a year, she came every week. Something was different, and whereas at the beginning you a little bit dreaded working with her, I mean, the truth is though, you, not dread, but you just kind of went, oh, this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere, I don't know if it's the middle of the year, something changed, and it got, it's like, I want to work with her or something. And then by the end of the year, she just wasn't depressed. I don't know what it was. She just wasn't. And it was just remarkable, you know, like truly remarkable. But then I noticed over time that other people would seem to be working on the same issue or something even after a while, so it's like there would still be some circle rather than the moving out from it that we would like focusing to have. So, something about the recurring story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got interested in, well, you know, what makes some people like seem to really change who they are. I mean, the whole effect that they have on you is different. Whereas others seem not to quite grow in that way. They're getting help each week. They're funded.
Mm-hmm.
But so, and so I started working on that and got very interested in that.
Of what it is that makes people change and some people not change.
Yeah, and to change at a deep, profound level.
Yeah. Yeah, at a profound level.
Yeah, that was. And then along about that time, I kind of felt like I'd been working on the idea of having a more long-term relationship. I'd been married in my 20s, quite young, and just kind of scared to death of doing that again. But I'd say, well, it's been 8 or 10 years, and so I could take it seriously again. And I started doing what I call the long-term project. I think the first time I admitted being ashamed to be working on something as primitive as finding a relationship or something. And one of the developmental courses I studied had reported this was kind of evidence of a lower developmental level.
Yeah.
But when I said it and said, well, I don't care, that's what I want to work on, that it really was a shift, and I would say most of the time after that I just kept working on this from many different angles, and it really did move. And so that was kind of the other place that Changing the Unchangeable started to develop. It was a lot out of that initial project and stuff.
And how did the name come about?
That's a good question. I get that. Everyone loved the name, but
yeah.
I think it came from I'd studied Aurobindo, this mystic from India, sage, and he wrote books like The Life Divine and stuff, and there was one wonderful phrase, I just loved it. He said, let's don't exaggerate the unknowability of the unknowable. I just love that phrase.
Yeah.
So somehow that got me into, you know, adding the ubble to things, unchangeable.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the unknowable and stuff like that. So
the unknowability.
So it kind of came out of that, I guess.
So in a way, it's like just saying it already puts you in a space of where there is a part of that mystical current in addition to just a practicality.
Yeah, well, that's very insightful, because over a long time the Changing the Unchangeable work came to be a place where the work I'd done studying consciousness kind of came in, but rather than coming in its form, it kind of got recreated in a focusing form, I think is the way.
Mm.
there was certainly a crossing or an influence there. I don't, something like that. So that was great fun. And so, I mean, then I started teaching actual workshops with a fee, small fee or something, and people came, and I was going through internships and licensure at the time. And I was doing a number of things. I was studying clinical developmental subject-object psychology of Robert Keegan and doing some behavioral medicine, Dan Brown, and just studying a lot of things that you do when you're in those stages, and actually every stage. And then I just noticed that the focusing just kept creeping into my work, you know. I'd be working mm-hmm. with clients or something, and it would keep kind of having some little outcome, not once in a while, you know, spectacular, but often more simple.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that I felt better from doing these groups and stuff, and developed some friendships, like Bukaitis and Sarah Glenn, I think, were just two very dear people. I mean, there are many others from that group. Jan is another one. And Susan, and I mean, there are just lots of people. But that's where this thing of that focusing gives back more, that just I would do things over time. Oh, I've been doing this for a year or two. Is this really working for me? I would mm-hmm. ask that question. And then I would always say, well, hell yes, this is really working for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you say that focusing has been giving you more than you put into it.
Yeah, just, it's once in a while it's spectacular, but it's more like it just keeps on coming back or something, and so that was the way it was in those early years, and all of that was before I got involved with international movement. I went to an international, and I'd had contact with Jimin through another organization that I was involved in, that he was involved in, and then I'd met him back at that AHP thing. So I was kind of coming in with links to him, and having been teaching a fair amount, and it was really just a spectacular. Yeah, that was spectacular, to go to the Focusing International.
Yeah.
Really something. That was in the early 90s, and I haven't missed one concert since then. And I think that's the same thing, that when I sit down and would look at how the conference would go for me, I would say, you know, that really was quite good. I really need to go again, you know, because I would do an evaluation of what was working for me, and so
yeah.
I really need to go to that again, and I would start developing more workshops, and they made me a coordinator, and so I was doing training programs, and so I got involved at that level of the whole organization as well. And so along in there somewhere is when I also started developing domain focusing. Because I got very interested, some people really learn focusing well, and immediately you work with them and you feel this whole thing that just was really well developed. And then other people, it would feel to me like they would move back into telling stories and not doing the self sense. Like, I'm telling stories mostly now, but
that's a different mode.
That's right, it's a different mode. And so I thought about it, and so I really got into if people really learn to distinguish between thinking and self-sensing so that they were moving back and forth between the two, or between regular conversation and then this thing where you stop and you go, how am I? What's it like inside? And just a whole kind of different rhythm emerges. So that was, and I noticed that when I outlined sessions, I got very into outlining sessions as an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that in our group, most people would kind of do some thinking or regular conversation for a while. And then they would decide, I'll drop in here or something. They would say something that seemed more interesting. They'd drop in there. And then they would do the clear felt sensing kind of thing. And then at any moment they would move out of it and go, now I want to think more. And I thought, the six steps doesn't really exactly describe that. And so I want to have a model that does describe that. So anyway, that came up with these two domains of thinking and felt sensing. And
so for people who are not familiar with it, one of the things, one of the things that we could say is that what you do is you've observed, for instance, the difference between the thinking mode and the felt sensing, and you help people be aware of when they are in one or the other by shifting the chairs you're in.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a big breakthrough. For a while, I would just be telling people, you're thinking now, or you're felt sensing now. But then, then it could be kind of a judgment and stop everything. So I figured out, I don't know how actually, but I figured out that if I would just move between these chairs, it would give a visual response. Mm-hmm. The focuser, and they could just close their eyes and ignore it if they wanted to.
Right. So it's not obtrusive in the sense that you're not stopping their process, but they have an immediate feedback, almost like a biofeedback, of what mode they're in, and so that's an important information in terms of learning to recognize the various modes when you're in them.
Yes, and it meant that as a listener, they were really learning to differentiate the modes, because some people would just kind of reflect back whatever would come, but they wouldn't really be differentiating, between thinking and felt sensing or that kind of thing. So if you're moving between the chairs, it's asking you to make this kind of a differentiation.
Right.
Also, as a listener is a good moment for that, because as a focuser it's a little harder to try and be shifting chairs. I did at the beginning. I had both of the strands of focuser chairs. It was a bit wild, and I also, because I would teach level ones a lot and people would be new, I would say, well, you know, because the listener moves to the felt sense or moves to the issue chair, the thinking chair, it doesn't mean they're right. This is just their take on it. They could
be right.
You know, and everyone loved that. You know, they just loved, oh, they think I'm in the issue chair, that only they move. Or, so there were a lot of fun things.
Yeah, so, but also what it does is there's a sense of not being passive, and at the same time having empathy, which is an interesting thing, because it doesn't mean having empathy is to be just following passively whatever the other person is doing.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned empathy, because at the beginning there were just two domains. You know, issue and felt sense. But then I would get stuck, like someone would not find a felt sense, and so all I could do is go back to the issue. For years I had wondered, what is going on with the critic in Jenin's model? Or what is going on with the focusing attitude? Lots of long-time focusers would talk about the importance of kind of being non-judgmental with yourself, and they would call that the focusing attitude. And so I like these things, both the work with the critic and the focusing attitude, but I was going, well, what is this? What is the function underlying this? And I must have held that question for a year or two. I mean, it was like a pretty thin time. I wish I could remember when I first formulated this, but at some point I came up with it, and there was this third function of self-empathy.
Yeah.
And that it helped the other thing. So if you got stuck, you could always go to self-empathy. And that was just terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's terrific. And really, then the domain and self-empathy would grow, and I would develop another function to it. And, people would kind of just keep going further in domain focusing, and I would keep developing it more. So
in a way, again, for people who are not familiar with this, it's you think of almost, instead of thinking of a road that is that just has one lane, you have three lanes, and in each of these lanes you have the various stages of focusing, but there's a different flavor or a different sense of what happens in each of the lanes.
Yeah, that's a very nice image, Serge. I kind of appreciate that. It just describes it very well. And so a big thing happened in the late 90s. Mary Hendricks Zinman had a training group in New York, Group One, as they like to call themselves, and she couldn't be at a workshop, so she was trying to find someone to who could come, and so Boston was the place that was closest that had other coordinators. We actually had four at the time. And so apparently, I didn't learn this till later, she called up the other three because they were more senior than I was. And it was only like a week ahead, so none of them could come. They were all scheduled, and she called me up. And I said, sure, I'll be there. And I went, and I have, by chance, I'd been training a group of therapists in Boston, and this was a group of therapists, and so I just had things that were really right, ready for therapists, and I mean, I tried focusing on every client, and, you know, and I was so persistent, even with people who were averse to it, I would find these little ways of bringing it back in. So the institute, the people got very excited, so they started bringing me down every month or every other month, I would drive down from Boston to these workshops, and it was really quite wonderful for me. The people that the Institute brought were, again, just very interesting people. And so that clicked. And then just having more workshops, doing it more and having it set up for you. It was just very growthful for me. Somewhere around this time I started doing Changing the Unchangeable retreats couple times a year. So I had that going on, and then I had this going on, and then things start crossing back and forth, and it's a very exciting time when you have the opportunity to teach more focusing. It just really develops you in many ways.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that you do is you observe focusing in action, and you stay looking at it and observing it, and then come up with either different ways of applying it or of conceptualizing it. But there's a very strong sense of you having a relationship of observer and understanding and trying to understand something at a deep level and finding some subtle ways to communicate it with people.
Yeah, it really is like that. It's a crossing and a going deeper, and around this time, I did late 90s now, I went to the first TAE Thinking at the Edge, Jim on top, and it was this whole theory development. So I'd already developed this theory about domain focusing, and I'd written some things, and I'd developed this theory about changing the unchangeable, and I'd written a little bit there. But so then I would go back to a TAE 4-day workshop, and I would start developing the theory underneath or behind these things. And that would be ever so rich. I mean, that would just start, that made the whole thing to keep developing much more. Made it very exciting. And then around the same time, I moved to Costa Rica and started learning a second language. Wow, very intense and challenging. I would teach all my tutors focusing so that I could have 10 hours of listening per week if I needed. And And I ended up doing some training programs, and I no longer had a full-time practice, so it gave me more space to work on training and what's involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that and everything, I began coming back to New York and teaching them and mm-hmm. really developed the theories and everything a whole lot more. And, so just focusing just keeps giving back more.
Yeah. So is this a good way to end, or is there something else you would want to say to wrap this up?
I think I could end here, but hold on, let me just check inside.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to say that I really enjoy getting to know people as I'm teaching focusing, and that I feel very enriched by the people I've had a chance to get to know. So I guess it comes around to that people theme and the richness of the relationship. So.
Yeah. So that's a very strong sense that it's something that has been enriching and connecting.
Yeah. So I think I can end there. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Robert.
You're so welcome, sir.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.